Buddhist Summer School, Thursday afternoon, 1st September 1977. Let us deal with some of the questions first. Would you say that mindfulness is the basis or key to all the teachings? Unquestionably so. This is the linchpin of the teachings of living the religious life, as well as the actual practice of the living of the religious life. If so, does the purification of the body come automatically with mindfulness? The purification of the body undoubtedly accompanies the mental, psychical aspect of mindfulness. But I would hesitate to say it comes automatically. One's digestive process goes on automatically. Automatically is not a very good word in this context anyway. Because mindfulness implies being awake, being conscious. So the purification of the body, the keeping the body clean, is a conscious act, a conscious process. One may do it automatically, so to say, but then one is not keeping the body clean or purifying the body in any way mindfully. It is just being done as an automatic routine. But if you are mindful of what you are doing, that mindfulness with respect to purity as such affects the psyche too. Just as mindfulness with respect to the psyche affects the body too. I feel rather diffident about asking this question, as it seems crude and I have probably missed the point absolutely. I don't think one could say one misses the point absolutely. If one does, one could hardly formulate a question about it. Well, we understand. But what happens about all the people who, A, are just at the very beginning of the path, have no awareness of the religiousness inherent in man, and C, die in despair or anger or criminality or conflict? The simple teaching on reincarnation suggests they or something goes on having space-time to develop in. Or is it that most of us, specks of man dust, are a sort of huge cosmic joke? Many are called, but few are chosen. That is, many men must just live and die so that transcendence may realize itself through just a very few. These are questions which always arise. The people who are just at the very beginning of the path, or have no awareness of the religiousness inherent in man, or die in despair or anger or criminality or conflict. Now, what happens about all of them? Well, obviously those who are at the beginning of the path, if they are earnest and sincere, will continue to tread the path. have no awareness of the religiousness inherent in man. It seems to me somewhat difficult to visualize the person who lives a religious life remaining unaware of religiousness within him. In some degree or other, a man is aware of this something which is religious. If it is only in ordinary social terms of being cooperative with his fellow men, his fellow workers, his family, his team, his club, his side, so to say, and so forth. So, this feeling of fellowness, this feeling in terms not exclusively of I all the time, like an immature man who has never passed his childhood or at best his early adolescence, there is a sense of a greater whole. And this sense of a greater whole than one's own psychophysical organism is one of the symptoms of the religious awareness. Something more than I. So the fact remains that no person can be totally, exclusively self-centered. And in that, there is the essence of religiousness. However little it may be operative in a powerful sense, however little the person may be conscious of it as such. What happens to those who die in despair or anger or criminality or conflict? Well, the bulk of people do die in conflict. In despair or anger, a certain number. And then the simple teaching on reincarnation suggests that they or something go on having space-time to develop in. Now this raises a very searching and somewhat poignant question. Is there no hope for them? Now, we must realize it is the totality, it is transcendence which comes to flower or fulfills itself or continues to operate. In any case, it continues to operate in anybody and everybody. You see? But we think in terms of ourselves developing. The sense of development, of growth, of reaching towards fruition of ourselves as truly representative human beings is something that doesn't come to everybody. And as in actual fact, totality is unconcerned with that. Consider a tree. It consists of several innumerable parts, each of which fulfills a function. Everything doesn't become the fruit or the flower on a tree. The bark is the bark, the root is the root, and so on and so on. The root never sees sunlight. the trunk and the bark and the rest of the tree never knows what it is to be under the ground, and so forth. You see, we mustn't think, it is unwise to think so, that our development must of necessity come to its ultimate fruition. That is to say, an ultimate which is formulated by the intellect. So many people with ability, with gifts, are frustrated in life, or they deliberately do not use their gifts. For instance, some people may go to universities and develop some remarkable know-how, some skill, some knowledge, and so forth. They get a degree, they could do a useful work in that field, say as a doctor or an engineer or whatever it is, and for some reason or other, they fight shy of following that profession. The years pass, and then they begin to feel, oh, I've just wasted my life, what use am I? And they feel despairing. But supposing a woman becomes a doctor, marries and has children, and has such a powerful mother instinct that she's not going to use her medical knowledge. She devotes herself entirely to the washing of nappies and so forth, and then after the years have passed, she begins to feel a regret. What a useless person I am. Supposing the children become geniuses, supposing they play a remarkable part in the life of society, if not for this woman who bore those children, that good to society wouldn't have come about. You see, we are so concerned with the self and evaluate and esteem the self and then superimpose upon our actual state an intellectual, conceptual ought to be. This is a mistake. We are all unique because of anyone and every one of us. The world is what it is. No one does not contribute to the world process, the world becoming. And both good and bad alike serve some extraordinary place and purpose in the universal scheme. So there's no point in vain regrets, remorse, or anything like that. But it is rather difficult to be able to have that all-inclusive outlook. So we become self-deprecatory. On the other hand, those who do find themselves very useful and so forth, and are very conscious of it, develop pride, conceit, and such things. You see, look at it in its wholeness. And if one can see it in its wholeness, then one sees with the eye of affection, regards everyone and everything with the eye of affection, like milk and water blending, to use the Buddha's phrase. You see, I am a nobody, a nothing in the world. Very good. I am a nobody, a nothing. How wonderful. I am the Arahant, the enlightened one, and I do my job. Unpaid, of course, and no pension. You see? How wonderful. The speck of dust is the speck of dust. How wonderful. The great galaxy is the great galaxy. How wonderful. That is all. Do not seek for the self. What happens, happens. Let be. The universe will go on both because of and despite us. So be happy. Be calm inside, that is. Seriously calm, seriously happy. Or is it that the question goes on, or is it that most of us specks of man dust are a sort of a huge cosmic joke? If one likes to regard it that way, very good. It is a good cosmic joke if you participate in it. And you can laugh. You can laugh with the cosmos, at yourself and against yourself. And it's all delightful. But mind you, cosmic jokes are sometimes overwhelming. Many are called, but few are chosen. Well, I think that's all got answered earlier. A tree. Everything doesn't become, every bit of the tree doesn't become a flower or the fruit. There are leaves, there are branches, there are stems, there is this, there is that, there is the other. 101, 1001 things. So, let be what is. And just be that. And it has its place and purpose in the universal scheme. For some years I have been meditating not on set themes, but, as I was instructed, on being aware of what was going on inside the psychophysical organism. The most important feature I observed, beyond the stray thoughts and a mute appeal to higher powers to enlighten me, was my heartbeat, where and how it is most clearly felt. In your description of the first three jhanas, I recognize elements which correspond to my experiences, but they don't come neatly in the order you mention, 1, 2, 3. They come higgledy-piggledy, mostly 1 and 2, in any one stint of meditation. A word of warning here. We talk about the jhanas, we read about them, we think about them. We don't really know them. The entry into the dhyanas is a very far developed state, very far developed. If and when one is able to enter the jhanas, one will know that there is no necessity for them to come in a particular order. The Buddha says distinctly, and in this instance he calls them stations of mindfulness. It comes in the phraseology used in the Mahanidana and the Mahapadana suttas. They are stations of deliverance. And the Buddha says that one can enter into, for as long as he pleases, any particular station and move out again as he pleases. You see? So it's, be careful, it's very easy to be self-deceived Not for a moment am I suggesting that one deceives oneself deliberately. Some people may do that. Perhaps quite a good few may do that because of the presence of self-esteem, vanity, and above all, ignorance. You see, people imagine that they have been in touch with the wonderful powers, agencies, supernatural, superhuman beings, and so on and so on. But beware of the tricks the psyche plays on oneself. When one really is in the jhanas, usually one won't classify them at all. One knows about it, but keeps quiet about it. The Buddha distinctly taught his monks, do not talk about this attainment or that attainment. And in the Vinaya, the book of the discipline, it was an offense, a punishable offense to do so, just as it was a punishable offense to display psychic powers under certain conditions. There were conditions when you did manifest psychic powers. There were conditions when you did claim the entry into the jhanas. So beware of that. It is very easy to be deceived about, and just as it is easy to be deceived about seeing visions, having clairaudient experiences, and so forth. These are all the tricks of the psyche, and they are endless in detail. That is one of the great reasons why the Buddha taught, put it all aside with right wisdom. Don't hold on to it. Don't give values to it, because then you'll be giving value to that which is perishing, that which is anicca, relative, mortal, not the deathless, not the transcendent itself. There are still obstructive, faithful there are still obstructive, faithless doubt, feelings of greed, hate, and fear, and I do fall into torpor occasionally. There is no rapture. Now you see, these are indications that the states into which one gets, one enters, when one is practicing meditation, are not the real jhanas. They are preliminaries. Do not think for a moment that they are to be discounted altogether. Not at all. They are there. Observe them mindfully. Discern what is true and good in them and utilize those for development. You see? There's no point in... We all know there is no point in throwing the baby out with the bath water. And you can't throw the baby out to separate the baby from the bathwater and then throw the bathwater away. Pick the baby up and take it out of the bath. So, pick that which is born in the meditative, in the practice of meditation. The living, that which will grow. And as the Buddha said, use that marvelous phrase, deal with it in such a way that you make grow the bud, the baby, into a full blossom, a full human being. Right? Something like that. But sometimes, after driving away a stray thought, I suddenly see a suitable solution of a situation that worried me. Now that is the useful part, isn't it? That is the fruit of that actual practice of meditation. And it's a worthwhile fruit because it conduces towards the real, the free emergence, the freer and freer emergence of one's inner religiousness to fruition. Above all, I can't abide in that state and often feel impatient that the clock ringing at the end of the stint, I can't quite read the word, it's within inverted commas, hasn't rung yet. Can anything be done? Just persevere. The Buddha said, summon up virya, energy. Be steadfast. You know, time and again, in the texts you will find, and so the bhikkhu, ardent, resolute, self-contained, meaning that the whole of him and all his life energy is being devoted to the task in hand, self-contained. This type of self-containment is not at all isolativeness. It is being continent, being chaste in the profound and the big sense. Continence or chastity is that utter self-containment which is not cutting yourself adrift or trying to cut yourself adrift from the environment. So, persevere. And may good fortune attend your efforts. Now, there are two unsigned statements here. If I am going to be the ruthless taskmaster, I would not deal with them at all. Because it has been distinctly put in the timetable notes, questions or comments, etc., must be handed over signed. Otherwise, how can I get into as full a rapport as is possible for me? However, I found the following this morning in Job, chapter 11, verse 2. It is the beauty of these quotations which softened my heart. Should not the multitude of words be answered? And should a man full of talk be justified? Verse 7. Canst thou by searching find out God? Canst thou find out the Almighty unto perfection? And the answer to those two questions decidedly is no. Canst thou by searching find out God? God in his own godliness, in his complete godliness, is the unknown and the unknowable. I will pass by you, but you will see only my back and not my face, said the Lord God to Moses. It is like that. Job, of course, belongs to the Old Testament. Canst thou find out the Almighty unto perfection? I should be God himself if I can find out God to perfection. So man cannot. To aspire that way is to aspire the wrong way. I must know all about you, God. And the eyes of God glow, and all around becomes utterly dark. And whoso has the temerity to stare at God gets burnt up by the light that emanates from those eyes. The sleepless, immortal eyes, which by their seeing give birth and also strike with death, like the arrows of Phoebus Apollo in the Greek teachings and mythology. So, never presume upon the transcendent. There is this apprehensiveness, this fear when facing the transcendent. This fear, which is not cowardliness, which would make you turn tail and fly away, but which will fill you with awe, reverence, wonder, and if the passion to give yourself wholly with asking nothing, then the everlasting arms take you up into itself, and the manhood was lifted up into the Godhead. The person who functions in terms of vijnana does not achieve as a conquest, but through grace is lifted up into the vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato bhava. If he cut off and shut up or gather together, then who can hinder him? No one can. There is one other here which I will not deal with at the moment. Whoever wrote it, it's unsigned. Please come and talk to me personally. So now we are at our last meeting for this summer school. I want first to thank you all from the bottom of my heart for all your goodness, your kindness, your generosity, your appreciation, which you have tendered to me. It has meant a very great deal, and it will mean more and more as the days go by. Tomorrow, speaking in terms of time and its tyranny, we shall be going away. Some of you will be staying on here, of course, but a good many of us will be going away. Do not feel it or think of it, regard it as separation. The cords of communion are only being lengthened. And in that lengthening, probably those who bear truth and love and wisdom in their reality, in their hearts, will be able to draw into that lovely circle of friendship, others, as we call them. And those others are not others in the sense of beings who are cut off from us. Not at all. We are all interrelated, always interacting, both knowingly and unknowingly. If we stay mindful, then that interaction between them and the best and the beautiful in ourselves is productive of peace and happiness and well-being for them also, as well as for you, as individuals. Do not use the intellect to make a picture of what ought to be the good thing in relation to the other. Be at peace. Make no pictures. Let the heart be full of love, quiet love, unpossessive, undemanding. Be extremely mindful, and in that mindfulness, in the moment, you will know what to do in relation to your fellow man. Don't try to picture what is good for him. That may be, in fact it usually is, 9 cases out of 10, an imposition by oneself upon the other person. It's the expression of our egoism manifesting itself as power lust, domination, not true dominion. How much we see this, how much we have seen it and known about it in the world's history. We see this in the outlook and attitude and behavior of parents and teachers towards children. I want my child to be like this, this, and this. The directions in which I have been frustrated in life, I want to see my child grow up and fulfill it. We all know about it. Again, be mindful. And then in that mindfulness, one will learn how naturally and spontaneously to cease to do evil. And then that verse in the Dhammapada goes on to say, strive to do good. Rather than think of it in terms of striving to do good, be so mindful that you let the good happen. You let it emerge. You see, one of the extraordinary things about true mindfulness is that when you pay attention in the true and the full sense to any person, object, situation, problem, event, it begins to speak to you in the immediate living now. It yields up its message to you, what it needs, It yields up its own truth to you. And you see the truth in its wholeness. The truth about that person or problem or situation. And when you do that, in this complete mindfulness, whatever problems oneself has move out of the picture, because those problems obstruct your mindfulness. And when the person or thing yields up its secret to you, its truth to you, then quite naturally, spontaneously, you just know precisely what to do. And if physical action is needed, the physical action is also performed. This is something which the world doesn't know about. And the world cannot believe this is possible. But this is the reality. Consider what used to happen when any one person came to the Buddha and spoke to him. He didn't answer everybody in the same way. He didn't suggest any course of action, etc., to everybody in the same way. Each person is unique. His needs are his particular needs. In that moment and at his stage. And the Buddha never reacted. He saw truth straight away. The fact of the person, the fact of the situation. And he responded deliberately, not out of intellectual activity on his part, but through this unerring insight, the Mahaprajna, Buddhi in action. Buddhi is what Plato, for instance, called nous. That is Buddhi, nous. You see? Now, we have some idea, at least, of the kind of thing that can happen, and the best way, the least harmful way in which it can all happen. So you don't have to strive to do good. Because you are wholly mindful, you are wholly the sort of person who does not impose self upon the situation. Therefore, you can let the good emerge. Transcendence itself is here and now. Transcendence never compels. God as such, let me use the theistic phrase because so many of you have this personalistic, devotional, theistic feeling inside yourselves. God himself never compels. He allows the devil to rise up and lets him go to hell and reign there and tempt man. Doesn't interfere. We are terrible interferers with life's process. And in that respect, and because of that, we are not real brahmacharis, treaders of the path, which means the living of the holy life. So strive to do good is not the best way of understanding it. So it seems to me. Let it happen with this intense mindfulness. Because in this intense mindfulness, true compassion will operate out of you. And it is that true compassion which is the warm, living, creative source of true understanding. The parent who is a truly loving parent, not imposing herself or himself upon the child, understands the child and just knows somehow, one can't explain it, just knows what the child's need is. And if he and she are highly developed, skilled parents, they also just know what is the right course of action in relation to that child. This is a great art, a supreme art, something which expresses the true humanity in oneself coming to fruition. And then, that last item in that verse, in the Dhammapada. Purify the mind. Now I have explained already and have openly said to you that this is my arbitrary presentation, separating the idea of what the psyche is from mind. The mind, if you like to regard it in the way I regard it, is the total mind. It is absolutely pure in itself. There is nothing to purify where that is concerned. But the representative of mind in ourselves is the psyche. And that psyche is your own psyche. And that is the thing that, because of ignorance, lack of knowledge, because of the natural drives of the organism, because of the incapacity to understand the trends of life and that towards which we are growing, it is that psyche which has defilements in it, therefore. That is the situation offered to us by fate. Fate, the big thing outside us, the environment and so forth, the laws of the land, the institutions, etc., the interactions between nations and so forth, all that constitutes fate, that throws a challenge to each and every one of us. And the mistake is to attempt to stand up against fate. Classic example of that, one classic example of that is Beethoven. They say he fought against fate and won. In a sense, yes. But that creative genius was of such a nature, and he was deeply religious in the profound sense. He was of such a nature that he was able to absorb all that conflict, that struggle, that misery, let it undergo a transmutation in the depths of his consciousness, and what poured out was not a conquest, but that supreme fruit of mindfulness which had touched the creative depths and heights of pure beauty, of the manifestation of transcendence itself, coming to fruition as perfect music. It is true that his conscious self fought against circumstance, but there is something profounder and deeper than that. When fate throws out the challenge, observe the movement of life. Observe it very carefully. Observe it dispassionately. Become aware of what is required from you yourself. And realize that your own inner pattern of destiny, your special responsibility, the web of your special responsibility out of the deeps of your own consciousness has to come into play with that web which is fate. It is as if two great vibrating spheres of energy intermingle like that, come in and go out, and come in and go out. They are two separate spheres, but they are completely related. They interact. There is an interfluence, an interflowing between your destiny, your individual personal destiny, and this thing called fate, which is the world's circumstance. Understand it that way, and all the useless questions about free will and determinism and all the rest of it will vanish, like the morning mists today vanished some hours after the sun rose. You see? So you purify the psyche. That is the way of the Buddhas. Now, when you go away from here, you will meet the shock, the noise, the turmoil of what fate presents to you if you live in the big cities and so forth. Observe mindfully. Try and absorb that within yourself. Yours is a greater task, a greater challenge than that which was presented to the people of olden days, when life was in some respects easier and smoother. That just indicates that in some way or other mankind has grown, has developed. If that were not the case, mankind would be crushed out of existence, perhaps. But far from being crushed out of existence, the population of the world, from being measured in just 200 or 300 million in the day of the Buddha, the total world population is now 4,000 millions. You see? So we are not being crushed out. We are not yet at the dinosaurian, in the dinosaurian condition where nature said, out with you, my children, you can go to your eternal rest now. It's not that. So, have courage. The courage which will yield all the time. Don't go under. You will have the strength, the power, and true strength, true comfort. Comfort means with strength, force fortis, strength. Is infinite resilience. If in your inner self you can be infinitely resilient, then the secret of the void and the fullness is yours, and you will know what liberation means. Once again, thank you, all of you, and peace and happiness be upon all of us.